Hello and welcome to the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And this week, we're very excited because we are in conversation with Simar Singh from Unerase Poetry.
So at the young age of 16, Simar started the initiative Unerase Poetry, where he promotes poets and their performances of spoken word poetry. And from a very young age, he'd been into theatre and performances. So after having tried his hand at stand-up comedy, the young poet inside Simar decided to bring the art of spoken word poetry, which combines poetry and performance, into the lives of Indian art lovers. And through his own initiative, Unerase, not only has he encouraged many poets and performers, but he's also performed groundbreaking poetry himself.
On 8th April 2017, Simar performed his poem, The Legal Rapist, a graphic and thought-provoking piece on marital rape. His 3.5-minute performance has rendered thousands of fans, including myself, speechless by the sheer honesty of his voice and maturity of his thoughts and ideas. Ever since the video was released, popular news and media companies have picked up on it, and rightly so, Simar's voice is resonating among the masses. So we at Desi Outsiders feel happy to be able to interview him ourselves so that you can hear his story right from the horse's mouth.
So without further ado, let's jump right into the show.
Welcome to the show, Simar. We're so happy to have you. I was just saying that there are probably very few people out there who haven't heard you perform your spoken word poem, The Legal Rapist. And that one, it definitely blew up. It got picked up by so many social media channels and so many people have written about you. I feel that you're quite a famous self-made 16-year-old. So how does that feel?
It feels pretty weird at start. Not used to all these things, but it's fun. It has its perks. It has its ups and downs.
It's okay, Simar. I'm sure you won't get to the stage of Britney Spears. but when Ankita and I first saw your performance, we immediately knew that we had to get in touch with you. And I actually remember sending the message to Ankita like, this boy is amazing. We have to get in touch with him, because it just blew our minds. And it blew my mind even more when I found out that you were only 16. So Ankita, what were you doing at the age of 16?
Why do you have to bring that up right now? I remember when I was 16, what I was doing was not being productive, and I didn't even do my homework on time. I was quite a loser.
Yeah, I was probably annoying my parents with like my teenage attitude phase when I was 16. But Simar, you're not a loser like either of us.
No, trust me. It's the same scene here. Just 6 months back, everything was happening the same way with me as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So there are probably a few people out there who haven't maybe watched your performance or seen the performance that we're talking about. But this poem was The Legal Rapist was written by you, and it was performed by you as well. So just for the benefit of our listeners who haven't seen or heard about this poem, do you mind just summarizing it for us and just telling us a little bit about the theme and the tone of the poem?
Okay, so The Legal Rapist was something which I wrote at a poetry tournament. There is the Tuning Folks Cafe where I regularly perform, and one of the places where I started my poetry journey from. So we have tournaments once in 2 months, and it was one of these tournaments. So how it works is they give you a prompt and you have to write a piece in that.
Right.
And I remember that week I was working on certain projects in my school. Yeah, because I'm still in school. So I stumbled upon a lot about marital rape. I went through a lot of articles, a lot of blog posts and personal experiences of people, and that was something which affected me because I hadn't seen something of that sort or heard something of that sort firsthand from someone I knew. But just reading about it made me sort of, I don't know, it gave me goosebumps. I used the tournament as an opportunity, you can say, because the theme worked well with what was going on in my mind, and that's how I wrote The Legal Rapist. And it's basically just about a female who is speaking about what's happening to her, how she's a housewife, and how she thinks that her job is something which she had chosen and she wasn't enforced to be a housewife, and how her husband loves her and how everything in her marriage is great, and how slowly she gets the realization of, you know, the patriarchy and the violence which exists within her own marriage, which she herself wasn't aware of. So,
and do you think, Simar, that a lot of you just mentioned that your poem depicts a story of a woman who only realizes till the very end that she's, as you say, you know, being raped legally. Do you think that it's a big, big problem across the whole of India and across the rest of the world as well?
Yeah, I think most of these issues, which I always thought these were national issues. These were some things we as Indians are facing. The West is developed, everything is great, but I was so wrong because before my piece, a piece by Aranya, which blew up the internet 100 times more than my piece.
I watched that one as well.
Yeah.
And Brown Girl's Guide.
Brown Girl's Guide to Gender.
Yeah.
It has garnered more than 50 million views all over the internet on various platforms.
Wow.
And when that piece was put up, we were contacted by all the who's and who's of each and every country. And I spoke to so many journalists, and what I got to know is it's the same situation out there as well. Whether it be Germany, whether it be Austria, whether it be the UK, whether it be the US as well. People are facing, women are facing similar problems all over the nation, all over the globe. Yeah, that's why the piece resonated a lot with people all over the world.
Yeah, and Simar, you're just 16, so we really find it surprising that at such a young age, and especially as a young Indian boy, you've been so perceptive of this important issue. And this is something very, very delicate. And this is something that I must admit that many grown men and women tend to either not notice or they ignore it, they turn a blind eye to it. So addressing it so openly, did you ever like go up to your parents and to grown-ups in your lives and actually address it openly with them before you went on stage and performed?
Of course. So marital rape as such isn't an issue, as I told you, is something which I haven't personally seen or heard of firsthand.
Yeah.
So that's not something which I've addressed a lot, but there are so many more issues which I've written about, which I talk about. And it's always, I think, as they say, charity begins at home. These conversations start at home. And it's always been my parents or some friends with whom these discussions have started, which have led me to write pieces about such issues. So now when I look back, I see actually most of my pieces are addressing some issue or the other. Even if I start writing about love, I will end up speaking about some social issue.
When you're talking about things like marital rape, and as you said that you want to write a poem about love and then it turns into something else, but these are the kind of things that we only get to know more about once we really dig in and do a lot of research.
Yeah.
It's not something that, I mean, you go out for dinner with your friends. It's not something you'll have on a dinner. It's not a dinner table conversation.
Agreed.
And do you think that this is something that really needs to be changed in India? Because I think that the poem that you performed, which is A Legal Rapist, I mean, for me, it was a kind of thing where I thought that actually this is quite normal, you know? Like when you spoke in the microphone, I thought, well, this is pretty normal. But I'm sure a lot of people must have listened to it and thought, well, I didn't know this actually happened.
Yeah.
So how do you think that we as a society can start changing these norms and actually breaking that barrier where it's okay to talk about these things, even at a dinner table?
See, so the tone of the poem, The Legal Rapist, how it starts is the girl, again, enjoying and being happy with what she has, and how she then realizes what she is actually going through and how she's being oppressed without even knowing about it. Now, I have, as a poet, I know I have only 2 or 3 minutes to say whatever I have to say. The struggle which I'm talking about is, say, a 200-year, 500-year-old struggle.
Yep.
So the first 1 minute of the poem is actually, say, the first 400 years where females didn't even know what is happening and what is wrong. It was unawareness because we as societies, not only the Indian society, we as societies didn't speak about these things. And the last 1.5 minute actually depicts the last 1 year when feminists, when gender equality activists started speaking about these things and they started making people aware. So the part where she says that I read an article and that's when I came to my senses, sounded sort of trivial to a lot of people. A lot of people criticized that how can a female just read one article and be like, oh, now I know my rights, now I know what's wrong, and I'm going to correct everything. But you need to understand where, as a poet, I'm coming from. It's actually not that one article. It's those movements, those struggles, those protests, which are all filled in that one line of that piece. So
that's really well done, the way you've structured the poem as well. I feel that it's a good thing you explained it in this way for people who might be listening.
Yeah, see, so as a poet, what I have figured out is, I am 16 in a 40-year-old's body, because I tend to write a lot of things which I myself don't understand. And say 1 year after I finish it and I read it again, I'm like, dude, this means like 10 different things when I read this now.
Mm.
So even the part where the guy says that, you know what, make me chai, and the girl says that I'm not really in a good mood, I'm sort of tired, so why don't you make tea?
Mm.
And he says no. And she says that his no had more value than her no, which as a quote is just something very normal. Okay, theek hai. He said no, she made the tea. But on another level, when you think about it, when she said no for sex, he was like, I don't care. But when she said no, even for the smallest thing. So it again comes down to a male's job and a male's role in the household, where he's not even ready to contribute to, say, make tea in the morning, and he expects the female to satisfy him whenever he wants, even though she does not want to.
Simu, you said that you're a 16-year-old in a 40-year-old's body. No, but speaking of your age, I read that you've been an active member of the theater community since you were 3 years old. Okay. And I feel that that's such a young and adorable age to be exposed to something, you know, something so artistic. So did you start performing on stage as well from the age of three?
Yeah. My first play, I played Mickey Mouse, and my first crush played Minnie Mouse. So it was great. I still remember the show. But yeah, I never met her after that.
No, so like, did getting exposed to the theater community, did that make you really comfortable just going up on stage and performing the way you do these days?
See, everything for me since my childhood has been theater. So when we're speaking about the things, dinner table conversations, and society not being open about these things, I think I've been lucky with the choice of parents God has given me, because my mother is a theater performer, and she started theater at the age of 15. And she started earning, like, as a profession. She was earning money in which she could run the entire family when she was just 15. My aunt, her sister, she herself is a theater, she's an internationally acclaimed theater director who's been working since the past 30 years. So it's sort of in the family where it wasn't an option for me not to take up theater.
And do you have any other siblings as well? Are they also in theater?
I have a younger sister. Yeah. So we didn't have an option. It's like when you're three, you have to go to school, right? So for us, when you're three, you have to do theater. You don't have an option.
It's amazing that you were introduced to this at such a young age.
I was forced actually when I was small, because I had to go after school, directly after school. That's how the classes were.
Right.
And it was a pain for me. I'm like, why are they making me do this and all that? But then, as a child, you don't understand what your parents have in mind for you.
So you grew up in Mumbai, right? Is that where you grew up?
No. I shifted to Mumbai 3 years back. See, my dad has had a transferable job, so I've moved around quite a bit. I was born in Chandigarh, which is the capital of Punjab, since I'm a Punjabi. I lived there for 3 years. We shifted to Mumbai for 3 years. Then I lived in Kolkata for 8 years. And then I came back to Bombay.
Can I just ask you, is your dad in the armed forces? Because my dad was in the Air Force, and we used to move from place to place every 3 years as well.
Yeah, I get that a lot. And since, like, we're Sirds, so, like, if you see someone with a turban, people assume that we're in the armed forces. No, he's not in the armed forces. He works for the corporate, but now it's, like, done. So we're going to stay in Mumbai for the rest of our lives.
Right.
So, Simar, because you've been moving around a lot, Has your surroundings influenced you a lot? Because I'm sure doing theatre in Mumbai, doing theatre in Kolkata, in Chandigarh, like, it is quite different. Because in India, when you're moving around different states, surely the culture and the vibrance around you and your surroundings would influence you in different ways. So how has Kolkata influenced you? How has Mumbai, Chandigarh, how have these places influenced you to be who you are now at 16?
Okay, so I again think I'm really lucky with this as well, where my dad had a transferable job, and each of his transfers have been so perfectly timed that they have completely worked out in my advantage. So I don't remember a lot of Chandigarh since I was just 3 when we shifted from there. But so the first part of my life where I was like conscious and I remember things was Bombay. And that's where I got to make a lot of great friends. Really met some really cool people. And when I was 6, I shifted to Kolkata. So that's the part where you actually start, you sort of get smart and you want to know stuff, you want to do stuff, first grade.
Simmer, at the age of 6 and 7, when you were so young, it's a very delicate and young age. I remember when I was 6, my mom forced me to enter like a Barbie doll competition.
Not that story again. Maybe,
wait, no. And I just want to say that I had like terrible stage fright. And I couldn't perform on stage at that age. And I couldn't even perform at home just in front of my own mom because I was too scared. So did you have that confidence even at that age just to strut on the stage and do your thing?
Yeah, so I would say I was born on stage because ever since I've been a baby, I've been told that this is your second home. And I'm so used to the stage, if I don't see the stage for, say, a month, it feels weird because it's like a part, I'm attached to it. So, the best part is, so again, coming back to the story, when I was 6, we shifted to Kolkata. And I'm so lucky to have spent 8 years of, you know, those crucial years when you're growing up, you're learning values and you're learning about society and you're learning about where you are and where you come from and who you are. And it was in Kolkata because Kolkata is a slow city. The people are very much involved in their culture and it is the city of art. Everything about Kolkata says art, whether it be the taxi drivers or whether it be an elite businessman, everyone is so attached to their art, to their culture, which made it even better for me. So I would say the main learning of theatre came for me from Kolkata. Because
I would have genuinely thought that for some Mumbai. Reason I thought you were raised in Mumbai.
Yeah, and I Mumbai thought that... is where I would have learned. Yeah, that's the general observation because see, Bombay is a very commercial place again, and everything about Bombay is commercial, whether it be the art or it be the
Bollywood
lifestyle. Yeah, Bollywood. So Bombay is a great place for you to take out all your skills and use them, earn money, but not a place where you can learn a lot of things. For me, from my experience, when I shifted to Bombay, I stopped pursuing theatre. So the article which you would have read where it said, I've done theatre for 11 years. I started at 3, ended at 14 because I shifted to Bombay at 14. And I couldn't, I tried theatre, but it wasn't theatre. It was something where they were just setting ticket prices and earning that money in those days. For me in Kolkata, it was that 3 months of just practicing, just rehearsing. And then those last 2 days when you just go out there and just take it all out.
You know, Meenal, you talked about how you got stage fright in front of your mom when you were young. You know, when I got stage fright, I got stage fright just watching Simmer perform because Simmer, the first time I watched you perform, The Legal Rapist, I noticed how you are a true performer. So you would speak really fast at some places. You would go really slow at some point. And I actually started getting a stage fright because if I were you, I would have definitely forgotten a line or two or I would have messed up my speech. I tend to do that even on this podcast. You don't know how much editing work goes into this. So I wanted to ask you, what's the kind of preparation that goes into each performance? And that too, not just yours, but also of the other artists that you promote. How much prep work goes in before you go up on stage?
Okay, so I'll speak for Anirez first. Personally, for each of our show, since we usually have, say, 5 to 6 points, each of them doing 10 minutes each. So it's a 1-hour show. The kind of preparation we do for the show is sort of a 1 week kind of a rehearsal. Not daily rehearsals, but it starts 1 week before the show with deciding the content, deciding the flow of the show, deciding which piece goes up, is performed first. Then it goes on to the music. Since spoken word poetry is generally not performed with music, the poets aren't used to music. And the musician isn't used to composing something to a speech rather than a song. So
no, one sec, Simar, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Meenal was too shy to ask you this question, but I'm gonna ask you anyway.
Yeah.
What's the deal with the boy with the guitar who plays during these performances? We don't even get to see his face, the poor guy.
I love him, man. I love him. So Pranav Kakkar, I think he's a blessing for Rani Rays, for me in my life. He's a classmate actually, and I've known him for 2 years. It was just an idea which struck me when I was working on Rani Rays. This idea just came to me that how about we just add something more to the poem? Why does it need to be just one person saying one thing and everyone listening to it? Like, because so I'm personally a filmmaker as well. I've been making movies since 3 years, right? So I'm aware of the kind of things we can experiment with in audiovisual. So when I thought of putting up a video, I'm like, there can be many more elements to this. So the first thing which came to my head was music, and the first person who came to my head was Pranav, because he is a genius, that guy. So you have just seen 8 videos on the channel which are up, but for every show we have at least 20 pieces which are performed, and this guy composes each of the pieces on spot, and all of them are original.
Really? So he has a different tune for every poem?
Every poem has a different tune.
Wow.
He does, you know, the pacing and everything so well. When you have a serious passage to convey, then the pacing, the speed with which he plays, everything is so brilliantly done.
Usually poems are not performed with music then.
Never. If you check out any other poetry channel, India hardly has any poetry channels. There are a few. If you see their pieces, none of them have music. If you see other poetry channels which are working outside, none of them use music. It'll be very rare if they collaborate with music. And at Anirudh, I've made sure that we will have music at each and every piece. And as poets now, everyone has become, like the poets at Anirudh have become so used to the music. When they go out and perform their pieces at other places where there isn't the musician, they're like, oh gosh, it feels weird.
Where's my music?
Yeah, where is the music?
The music does add so much more charm to the whole performance. It really does make a difference. Simar, I used to be a business skills trainer at one point in my life, and I used to have engineers asking me what they should do to prepare for a presentation, and I would tell them, like the amateur that I was, I would say, you know, perform in front of the mirror, practice in front of the mirror. But I know that that's not proper advice to give someone. Do you actually do that, and does that help before you go on stage?
Okay, if that's amateur, then I'm amateur, man, because that's something which I do and which most of the poets do.
Simar, we always feel that just because, like, when we watch you on stage, we feel that you have some special ingredients, like, to add.
There's something extra that you must be doing for the way you guys perform, which is why we're so curious to know what is the prep work behind this.
So I can't speak for each. See, every poet has their own kind of thing to prepare. Just yesterday, we had a workshop with college students, and we were teaching them different things about writing and speaking. So one of our poets, Mohammad Sadriwala, whose piece was the first piece we put up at Anirudh, he came up with this new thing, which I had never seen, is putting a pen or a pencil in between your teeth and speaking your entire piece just before you get on stage, which and what it does, it opens up your mouth, so the pronunciation of all the syllables come out perfect.
Meenal, we should be doing this too.
Yeah, for your podcast, you should. I did that before the first show, and it really helped me. It's very funny when you do it, if for people who are around you, seeing someone with a pen inside their mouth.
Before you go on stage, and you recite the poem in your head and then you go on stage, or do you have like a routine before you go on stage? Because I know some performers who go on stage, maybe they listen to some music or they'll do something else. But is that what you do? You recite the poem in your head with a pen and pencil?
So the pen and pencil thing is something which I learned yesterday. I'm still not able to figure out that one custom thing which I want to do every time I go on stage. Because every time I am backstage, I think of a new thing which I should do. So in the start, something which really helped me was listening to music. And it's always this one particular song. Yeah. So Uptown Funk is a song which I play just before my performance. I listen
Man,
to
Sim, if I listen to that, I would just start dancing and forget that I have to even go on stage.
I always remember Michelle Obama appearing on The Ellen Show and dancing to the Uptown Funk.
That is hilarious. No, yeah. So I don't know. It's just, it's something which feeds, my soul needs that kind of a song to feed upon before I perform. So I listen to that, just the chorus, the ending wala part. But recently what I've tried doing is try to calm myself down. So I take like 2-3 deep breaths, and I saw a video online which told me one of the easiest ways to meditate is when you close your eyes and you're breathing, all you need to do is focus on your breath. So I do these two breaths where I am oblivious of anything around me. I'm just focusing on the air going in, air going out, and twice, and then I go on stage and do whatever I have to.
And once you're on stage, how does your audience affect you? Do you feed off of their energy, or do you look at them? Do you pay attention to how they're reacting? Because especially since this is a poetry recital, pretty much, you can see a reaction only when you're done. But I know that you did stand up before this.
Oh, God, yeah.
So at that point, how did you feed off of the energy of your audience? How does it affect you?
Right, so I'll go back to my theater days, okay? And something which I was taught in theater is that it's a two-way performance. It's not you.
Yeah.
You're actually having a conversation with the audience each and every second you're on stage. Is it that they're speaking through their expressions, through their mind, and you're saying out words? And this is something which I learned when I was doing mime. I've done a couple of shows, and mime is basically when you don't speak, right? So I've done mime shows, and that's how we communicate with the audience. And that's what they taught me, that even when you're not speaking, you're saying so much. And that's the same thing with the audience is doing. Theater taught me a lot, how you can influence the audience's mind. It's not always about the audience looking at you and saying, okay, you're not that great, bro. Mm-hmm. Or saying like, okay, this guy's pretty great. I want to see more of what he's doing. And that you can see that for me, it's very important. Even if there are, say, thousands of people in the audience, and even one of them takes away their eye from me for even a second to check either their phone or the time, it's like, dude, you're not up to the mark. You need to improve.
But the thing is, Simmer, when you're performing poetry, it's slightly different to comedy, right? Because when
Very different.
Yeah. So when you have when you're performing comedy on stage, you will have laughs every 30 seconds, every minute. You know, you can sort of feel the energy of the audience. But with poetry, you only really know how the audience feels at the very end, right? Like once you finish your poem, and you will only be able to understand how the audience felt about your poem through their applause or through their reactions only at the end. So do you have this sort of anxiety for those 3 minutes where you're just waiting for a reaction?
So when I did stand-up comedy, stand-up is all about instant reactions. If you say something funny and the audience laughs, it means it worked. And if you say something and no one laughs, or there are just slight giggles, it's like, okay, sort of worked. And if there is death silence, that means, dude, you're great. But with poetry, there aren't instant reactions. But one thing which we do, which happens all over the world with poetry, is something called snapping. So you can't clap or hoot in between a poetry performance. Even if you love a line, you snap with your fingers like this.
Right.
And that is basically saying, okay, I agree with you, or it means, whatever you said makes sense to me. I like it. And there is you sort of get an idea of how the audience is feeling. But in a performance like The Legal Rapist, if you put on headphones and you listen clearly, there will be only one or two places where you will be able to hear snapping. Most of the places are death silence by the audience. And the reason is because I have put the audience in a very uncomfortable situation. They aren't ready to hear what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
For most of the men out there, they aren't ready to hear what I'm saying. For most of the female out there, they didn't know this is something which was up, so they don't know how to react. And
I myself actually held my breath in that place where you said he pulled me towards him, and there was a line that you said, so immediately I held my breath because I knew what was coming.
I was so into the legal rapist, like I wouldn't even like remember to snap my finger.
The way you're saying it, I was so into the legal rapist sounds really weird.
Okay.
Because people are texting me things like, we saw your legal rape online, you were good at it. And I'm like,
oh no.
Wait, can you please articulate compliments in a better way? Okay, this one guy texted me saying, yeah, you are the best legal rapist. Thank you so much.
Oh my God.
And I'm like,
that's hilarious.
I'm taking a screenshot. This is going on that wall of compliments, well, which I never wanted to
please,
share.
Yeah. Please send it to us. We can actually put it in the show notes for anyone who's listening right now. Go back and you can see the screenshot of someone calling poor Simmer a legal rapist.
Yeah, when I was making the decision of what I need to name the poem, it was like, okay, this might be taken in a wrong way by a lot of people, so just be careful. But I'm like, no, but this is what the poem is about. So it felt right, yeah.
So you were writing poetry from the age of 9, which is a very tender age. It's a very young age, especially for a lot of boys and girls, especially like me, who would probably just love to be playing outside, spending time outdoors with your friends. And, you know, in India, we're born with cricket in our blood. So I'm sure a lot of your friends were probably playing cricket as well. And were you involved in that side of your life as well? Were you also the kid who went outside to play, or were you mostly just...
Every
oh,
day.
You were? Okay.
So I started playing cricket when I was 7. And I played cricket for 8 years. Basically, my entire stint in Kolkata and 1 year in Bombay, I was playing cricket. I played like for a club, and we played like district level and all that.
Wow.
And I was sort of okay with cricket, but I think the artistic side of me just got me harder than that aggressive side of me, because I'm a very aggressive person as a cricketer. Like I've like broken wickets and like hit people with bats and all, and like shit like that. So something, not I'm advising people to do something of that sort, but
did you play in school as well? Because you've been moving from school to school. Did you play cricket in school?
Yeah, I played with school also. And yeah, but with school, I've been actually the best batsman for my school, because so like my highest score for school was like 7. Yeah, which is a very bad score. I was a very bad batsman when I played for my school. But
And now you're in the 11th grade or 12th grade?
12th. Now is the year 12th. When I have to be my board.
This is the year. And, you know, this is the time when most kids are forced to think about their career choices and their future plans and things. But from where I'm standing, at least, it looks like you pretty much have it all completely sorted out. So is that actually the case?
No, man, not at all. I'm a very confused person. So till 14, I had to be a cricketer, and I had, like, there was no option. I had written down my diaries. Even when I wrote poems, most of my diaries, after every 10 pages, it was like, whatever you do, you have to become cricketer when you grow up. And it was like that sorted. But at 14, I don't know, I just fell in love with poetry. No, not with poetry, but I fell in love with art in general, with filmmaking and things like that. And I just started doing those things. And then Anirez was not something which I thought, okay, this is your career. This is the end all and be all. This is how you're going to earn. But it's just something I wanted to do. I just thought...
Your passion project.
Yeah, poetry needs to reach that certain level. And it worked out so well. It's just been 1.5 months. And I'm like, okay, I could actually make a living out of this, but this is not like my goal in life. I still want to make films. I still want to...
It's just such good quality you put out there. That's why in 1.5 months, this has seen so much success, because it's amazing quality work that you and, you know, your fellow artists are putting out there. That's amazing.
I know. See, as artists, you don't know how good or bad your work is. It's just that... Mm. Is this something you've written, something you've done, but you don't know how it is? So as poets in the community, all these pieces which have went viral, which have been appreciated so much, they were just pieces we had written, we were reciting, and many of them were like, we're done. I performed this 5 times, I'm done with this piece, I'm going to write new pieces. Because there is no place in poetry where I'll be like, okay, so many people are going to watch me and going to appreciate my work. It's going to be those 50 people I know, and maybe those two, three odd people who have ended up at a poetry open mic, but were supposed to go for stand-up comedy because that's the in thing now.
Well, that's what happened to you, Simmer. Don't blame it on everyone
else. That happened to me as well. But
Simmer, you're doing your board exams now, right?
In March next year, yeah. No.
Oh, March next year.
So I have these 6-7 months when I'm like, I got to prove myself, and I'm like, even if I fail, I have this side sorted.
So I'm sure it won't get to that stage, Simmer. I'm sure you see, if you can become the highest scoring batsman in your school, I'm sure we can get through this as well.
Okay, that's just more demotivating, because if I see my class 11 mark sheet.
You know, in the school I went to, because I studied in India and Meenal studied in Europe, so I know how the Indian school system works. So the school that I went to, it gave the students only two options for 11th and 12th, which was biology and computer science. So if you wanted to become an engineer, you choose computer science. And if you wanted to become a doctor, you have to choose bio. And I wanted to become neither, so I chose the lesser of the two evils, which was computers. And, you know, that's pretty much all the thought that went into my future and career at that point. And that was 8 years ago. And I'm hoping that you guys have it a lot easier and you guys have a lot more options, and that the schools hopefully think that engineering and medicine are not the only two career choices available. So what subjects, really?
So I don't know. I'm very lucky again, because the school I'm studying in, I think it has to be one of the coolest school in the city, because they let us do whatever we want to. They let us study whatever we want to. And they're so chill about...
What subjects did you choose, actually, for your 11th and 12th?
I'm doing humanities right now. But
awesome.
My school did not have humanities till last year. And because most... It's end of the day, the subject choice is not something which the school gives you, but it's more of what parents want you to do. And accordingly, they choose your school. So in my school, which is a very academically focused school, because it's a lot about getting great marks and other stuff also. So it was a lot about becoming an engineer, getting in an MNC, going abroad, or maybe doing an MBA, starting your own startup, or maybe becoming a doctor, or neither of those. Then you
I know how that feels.
Commerce was basically the second option if you're not good with these technical subjects. Humanities wasn't an option for people. I'm like, cool, my school does not have humanities. I'm going to do, we have junior colleges over here. So I'm going to do junior college. I'm done with school. I'm going to chill. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to party, all these things and all these aspirations. I apply for colleges. I don't get in the one I wanted to. I'm like, okay, chalega. I'll apply at some other schools. Admissions have already closed. I'm too late. I have no option. The only option I have is calling up my principal, who's the best person in the world, and telling her, you have to start humanities or I'm going to like have a gap year, and that's going to be very scary for me. And she's like, okay, we're always there for you. No, the principal was like, because she was behind me, that you can't leave our school. And like, I always told you, and now we're going to start humanities just for you. And then I got in a couple of my friends. I'm like, dude, let's just continue in school. And they're like, okay, even we're not...
Wow, Simmer, it feels like you're going out to set a revolution in India. Changing schools, poetry, what else do we have coming?
I would love to be
I had
that,
humanities
yeah.
when I was in school.
Yeah, I'm in love with the subjects. I'm in love with the way we're taught. Of course, the curriculum part from, say, the government, the board, is something which they don't really put a lot of effort. At least we don't see that effort. So that's sort of lacking. But again, the school is so great. So we don't only stick to textbooks. We see films. We read stuff. We go through a lot of speeches. We have a lot of open-ended discussions. And especially with things like sociology, where we're discussing the caste system, or say things like the patriarchy in society. Marital rape also is something which we've discussed a lot. It's out of the textbooks.
So Simmer, all of these things surely actually, all of these things are constant sources of inspiration for you, right? Like when you're writing a poem or when you're thinking about an idea for a film or for a movie, I'm sure that your school probably plays some role.
A major role, yeah.
And is there anything else that you do? Do you read any specific books? Do you watch any specific movies that inspire you to create poems that you like you do?
So, I really hate myself for this, but I've become a very bad reader since the past 1 year. I was like completely into reading till the last year, and it was like I used to complete one book in 2 days and then take a mm-hmm. 1 day break and then move on to the next book. So like 1 month I had to read at least 4 books, and mm-hmm. but when my 10th grade came towards like the ending and I had my boards, then the only things in front of me were my textbook, which weren't that informative about like things I wanted to know about. It was a lot about science and maths and all these things, and that's where I just lost that knack of reading. So I've read books after that, but it's not like something which I just want to do all the time. So for inspiration, I look at books which I had read back then. For inspiration, I look at movies. Movies are something which I do a lot. So luckily in 11th grade, I didn't have a lot of pressure to study. So there was this like 3 month period where I used to have like a movie marathon at night. So I had to see mm-hmm. minimum 2 or 3 movies ratko. And they could, in the night, they could be any kind of movies. Like I've seen the stupidest movies. No, I've not seen a lot of Hindi movies in that time, a lot of English and international movies. Even if they were stupid, I'm like, even if I'm seeing something bad, I should know, okay, this is something which you don't need to do. This is...
So Simmers, do you study the movies as you're watching them as well? Or do you just sit down and just watch it as a leisure sort of thing?
I hate myself for this again, because I have to study the movie because I'm not even an F of a filmmaker, but I sort of have an idea of it. So whenever I'm seeing a movie, rather than other things, I will be looking at the shots, I'll be looking at the transitions, I'll be looking at what people are doing in the background, the kind of color they have used, the kind of why is that person wearing this, and why is she looking there when she's saying this, and why is all of this happening?
Wow, Simran.
That shows how much you're passionate about this, actually.
Yeah, but then I end up losing up on, okay, what was the story again? What was I tend to forget movie names. So what was the name of the movie I saw? Okay. I know movies by directors and not by names, so that's weird. But
are you actually planning to apply to colleges? Did you start the application process? Like, how does it work now?
I don't want to go to college, man. For two reasons. Firstly, because I'm so in love with school. I'm so used to going to school. It's like, I don't want to wear the clothes I wear in home and go to the place I study in. I'm so used to wearing that uniform. And the second thing why I don't want to go to college is, I don't know, I just feel everything is so commercialized these days. Like, I don't want my parents spending like these many lakhs and crores on like 3 years or something, which I'm probably not even going to use that much when I grow up. Like, I think college is more of a place where you go and socialize and you learn from experiences of people you meet rather than in classes, because that's what school has been for me. Like, I've understood a lot of things and I've learned about a lot of things, but dude, it's not worth 1 crore rupees, right? Like, I don't want to spend that much for something of this sort.
So imagine you got a scholarship and your parents don't have to pay anything to send you to the best college or the college of your choice, and you have the option to study, learn and grow in whichever way you want to. Then what subject do you think you would want to pursue if that's the case?
See, then I would love to go to college firstly. Because I believe I'm a big fan of Rabindranath Tagore. So he said that he looks for a world where education is free, and that's the kind of world even I personally want to live in. And apart from all these things, when I grow up, I know I have to make these certain changes in the education system all over the world, no matter where I'm in life. At a certain point of time, these are things which need to be changed, and I have to do them no matter what. So if I get that kind of opportunity, the subject I would like to study is again very confusing. Yeah, I don't know. I want to study filmmaking for sure. I want to study English literature. I want to study...
Really? I'm actually an English lit student. I mean, not a student now. I studied English literature for 5 years.
Oh, amazing. You can guide me through a lot of things.
Okay, so I think this is where I make a confession to you, which is that as a student of English literature, from the time I was 14, I was really passionate about literature and I knew that this is what I wanted to do. But I've never been a fan of poetry at all. And I thought that maybe pursuing literature is what is going to make me interested in poetry. And in the 5 years that I spent studying literature, I was not a fan of poetry. Yeah. And then I came across Unerase, and I must tell you, you've converted me. I wish I got to watch other poets perform their own poems. And I wish, you know, because I know there's a Sylvia Plath performance on YouTube, and that was interesting to me. And I wish that all poets got to perform, because this is so beautiful. And I must really thank you for bringing this art form into my life, at least, because it's just beautiful. Everyone should start watching your videos now.
No, that means a lot to me personally, because that's end of the day, this was my aim. I just wanted to grow the community, whether it be through an audience or a poet. Is people are a part of the community where they're either listening or speaking or just penning down their thoughts. But like, again, poetry is of two forms. One is the written poetry and one is the poetry we do, which is spoken word poetry. So not always everything you write can be spoken, and not always... No, it does not happen the other way around. Sorry. So spoken word poetry was something which had to... It's just the due which was left. When I saw it that way, and the first thing which came to my mind is all the other art forms have had their fair share of recognition, their fair share of being known, their fair share of making careers for people, but not poetry. Because
do you anticipate that poetry could be the next big thing now in India? Like, we have a lot of kids who want to get into Bollywood, who want to get into music. Do you think this could be the next big thing?
Yeah, that is why I started this.
I hope so too. I really hope so.
I've had this thing in mind. It's all sorted for me how I want to work out all these things, because I've been a part of all the art forms, if you see. I started with theater. I did filmmaking. Then I did stand-up comedy. And I've sort of done music with theater at times. Dance is something which I've not done. But so most of these art forms, I would love to learn dance. I'm the worst dancer. Plus, I'm like, I the only thing I know is Bhangra. So, like, I need a lot of space when I'm dancing. So, like, girls never dance with me at parties. I'm used to it now. No, so what I figured is that, the fair share, it's due for poetry, because poetry hasn't gotten that kind of recognition. All other art forms are commercial. You can earn money out of being either of the things I listed out, but not a poet. You have to be a writer. You can't be a poet. You can write blogs. You can write books. But you can't become a poet. You can't earn through poetry. So I'm like, dude, something is wrong. Maybe no one thought about this. It just passed, right? People, even poets who were a part of the community, they didn't think of it that way. They just were a part of it, and they didn't realize that this is something which should happen.
Yeah, so Simra, I know that you're only 16 years old, so it can be very difficult to answer this question now. But for anyone who's younger than you, or anyone who's maybe even older than you, who's aspiring to pursue their passions and to create something of their art form like you have, is there any advice that you'd like to give them?
I'm very bad at advice, but...
You didn't give the advice of the pen and pencil. I was going to say you gave good advice there, but...
Yeah, that wasn't mine. That was someone else. But no, so the only advice I can give people of my age or younger than me is that people aren't going to trust you. Like, they aren't going to believe in you. And it'll be very tough to convince people that, you know, you can do this. They know you have something in mind, but they know you can't pull it off. And it's very tough to, like, even in home, your parents will be like, ye pagal ho gaya. Isko ghar pe bithao, isko padhai karao. And like, what is this guy doing? So it takes time. It's a trust which keeps building with time. And when people know you only, it's only then are they going to have faith in your work, have faith in your passion, and are going to be as passionate as you about what you're doing. So it's the only advice is don't stop, dude, because that's something which I did when I was in the 10th grade, because I've done so many things and I was making films and a lot of films and I loved movies. And before my boards, I just had to stop because I didn't have the option to not study. I just had to study. And when I got back from my exams and I had 2 months free, then I'm like, I really don't know what to do anymore, because like, I don't feel the same about what I used to do now.
I think, Simra, that from this whole general gist of the podcast, I think that what you've really shown Ankita and I, or even our listeners, is that
you shouldn't accept no for an answer. You just keep going. And I think you've done that really well. Poetry is something, even art, just art form in general in India, is something that I feel that people look down on, especially our parents and of older generations. And it's not easy to pursue an art form. I mean, Ankita, you started a blog as well. And you know that it probably wasn't easy to explain to people what you were trying to do, and probably still trying to explain to people what you do.
Yeah, like recently someone sent me a message saying, what, you actually make money writing a blog? And that's, I'm really grateful to you for coming on the show, Simmer, for talking to us, and especially for, not just for younger people, because you're just 16. I feel that even for people like me who are 10 years older than you, you're such a source of inspiration, because you did it out of pure passion for all the things that you love. You did it just for the sake of, just out of love for what you wanted to pursue, and you've done a really good job. So thank you so, so much for coming on the show, and we've had an amazing time talking to you.
Same here. Thank you so much for having me on this. Because I'm personally a big fan of podcasts, and I love the idea of like having a conversation with someone and then like putting up a video, and like it's interesting. So I loved what you guys were doing, and I'm like, cool. I always wanted to do a podcast, and like, this is how we're gonna start it.
And fantastic, Simmer. Well, Simmer, I would wish you the best for your future plans, but neither of us know what your future plans are. So
neither do I.
Figure it out. You have to let us know.
But we wish you all the best in everything that you do. And thank you again for coming on the show. And we're looking forward to the next release on Unerased Poetry, Simmer.
Yes, just a couple of days, and yeah, we have some really cool content coming up. So yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Simmer.
Bye.
So Ankita, I feel that more than anything else, this episode has taught us not just one lesson, but maybe two or three or four or five about taking initiative. And at such a young age, Simmer took the initiative to do all the things that he's doing today. And he sowed the seeds years ago from the age of three. Well, his mom did. And now you're seeing the fruits that are bearing now from these seeds. And that's what's led to an entire generation of young Indian poets who are discovering and embracing the beauty of spoken word poetry.
Meenal, like I mentioned on the show, you know, I was a literature student myself, and in the 5 years that I spent studying literature, I never really enjoyed poetry, and it was just not my thing. But by watching the performances of these artists and these poets themselves coming out and performing their own poems, I've found this newfound, you know, love for this art form, and I think it's so beautiful. And I wish every poet performed spoken word poetry as far as possible. At least in India, we all have Simmer and Unerased Poetry to thank for bringing this into our lives.
So you can get in touch with Simmer at Unerased Poetry on Facebook, and you can get in touch with us at the Desi Outsiders. So do hop over to desioutsiders.com for the show notes to this episode, where we will leave links to Simmer's performance as well to his Facebook page and YouTube channel, where you can find a repository of artists and performances.
So until next week, I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And we are the Desi Outsiders.
It's a Saturday night and he's working late. My husband has been really busy lately. I hate that he gets just one leave a week, but I love that he can always make up for it. He says he loves me. I'm not a housewife for nothing, because most people don't know how tough it is to create the perfect household for your family. It's not that I didn't have the option to work outside. It's just that I chose not to, because what my husband does and what I do are equally important. We both are running companies. It's just that he makes money out of it. We both have employees under us. It's just that he has managers and I have maids. We both are trying to make two ends meet. He by earning the money and me by planning the expenditure. But this isn't about my career choices. This is about my love, my husband, who after a tiresome day of work comes back home to his wife. He opens the bedroom door. I'm lying on the bed with lots of pain in my head. He starts unbuttoning his shirt, taking off his tie. I get up to help. He holds me by my waist, pulls me towards his body. I say no. I had cramps in my stomach. I'm sorry for having my periods on a Saturday night, but it's okay. I'm sure he'll understand, because he says he loves me. So I whisper into his ear the state my body is in. He laughs it off and says, I'll manage something out. I look at him and say, there's nothing that needs to be managed, but my body is in no state to make any love to you. He pushes me onto the bed and jumps on me as if making love to him wasn't an option, but an obligation. He says he loves me so it didn't matter what state my body was in. I had to. It was my duty. I hated this quality about my husband. He was really dominating both in bed and in the marriage, but he slept early that night and I didn't. Because it hurt. But love hurts, right? So next morning he wakes up and he wants tea in bed. I request him to make the tea, but he says no. So I make the tea. Because that's also what love is about, right? Understanding when your partner says no, but my no had lesser value than his no, and it's justified because he earns for the family and I don't. But what happened last night repeated tonight, and my periods were still not over. But this time, I came to my senses. Thank God for social media, I came across an article. The article spoke about a phrase I had never even heard of, marital rape. How could it be rape if we were married? How could he be jailed for loving his wife? It all sounded so unreal but felt so true. He had been raping me now for months and years. He never asked me yes or no. I had to, is what my parents taught me, because no wife should say no to her husband because he says he loves you. But you could have said no to him when you were on your period, and you could have said no to him when you felt unwell, and you could have said no to him because you just didn't want to. So many wives have been victims of marital rape since years. So many husbands have turned into legal rapists from lovers. So many families have asked women not to speak about this harassment. So many FIRs have never even had the option of getting filed. So many young boys have been taught this crime as a ritual. So many young daughters have been trailed to fulfill their duties toward their spouses. I never had the option to work. It was an illusion. He didn't want me to. That was the truth. But as the society says, if marital rape isn't an actual thing and being a housewife is a job, then isn't this harassment at workplace?